I've heard a number of people join. We're just past the top of the hour. I just wanted to confirm that, Stefan, you are online, correct?
Hello? Adam join?
Hi, Adam.
Sorry, I'm late.
That's okay. We apparently haven't started yet. Just to confirm, Adam, did you hear me speaking?
Yeah, I heard you. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I was having phone problems yesterday, so it just occurred to me that maybe no one heard anything I just said either.
I was nodding.
Ah, perfect. Great.
While we're talking.
If only we could get video calls working, you know. We
this
need a technology
stuff
for that.
Will never be popular.
Yeah, we should have these meetings over email instead. I haven't heard any of the shares. Are they here? All right, Stefan?
Yeah, sorry. I talked a lot, but I was muted. So I just said, let's get started. It's 6 past the hour on my clock now.
Okay, I'm in. Hi, Alia.
Yeah, good. Welcome. So Dom pasted the agenda. The draft agenda into the chat, and we're going to start with some administrative stuff and then move on to a discussion about IDEAL and discuss consensus on how long permissions last. Then a bug walkthrough led by Harald, like in Washington, and then discuss what remains apart from closing all the open bugs before issuing a consensus for moving to last call. So, any comments, or can we go with that?
I'd just like to note for the record that we have a very few number of people here to actually be making many decisions. So I'm glad to have the discussion, but I think that we need to be very careful about how much we consider anything that happens on this call a decision.
Yeah, I agree. I made the same note. But
see, on the formal side, I think if we need to make the WTC doesn't have the make decisions and mailing lists thing that the ITF has. So if we so we'll definitely discuss things in both places, but I think we're in a situation where we have to make decisions, and we'll make sure that mailing list knows. We'll and then we'll discuss
them
again.
So Errol, I think you just basically told me we're making decisions on this call, and I object to that. I don't think you have enough people on this call to have decisions.
So, Cullen, I understand your concern. This is Dan. All I'm going to say is Harold is right that officially we can make decisions on this call because it was properly scheduled, properly announced, et cetera. And that the reason to make that statement is that so that there isn't somebody who can hold up the group by just failing to join the call. However, it is appropriate that you noted that we are missing many people. And if there is a decision that ends up being contentious – and, you know, numerous people on the list who were unable to be present had a concern, then I'm sure Harold would be willing to, you know, to open the discussion on that again. It's just that it is appropriate for people to understand that it is possible to make decisions on these calls.
Okay.
Yep. And yes, low attendance is it means that the bar for reopening issues later is lower than it otherwise would have been.
Correct. But to record any decisions, we need a scribe. Boom. Thank you. I can take over if you get tired during the meeting.
This is Frederick. I wanted to say something.
Please.
Going on what was just said before, what we could do is reach a rough decision on the call and know what people on the call think, and then follow up with a call for consensus on the mail list where you say, this is a decision we've reached on the call, you have a week to object or a week and a half or whatever, send it out on the mail list, and that way everybody who's not on the call has a chance to formally speak up, and when it's done, you know you've addressed the concern that they weren't on the call formally. And if there is a concern worth discussing, it's probably good. So I would suggest that the decision can be made on the call, but followed up with a call for consensus to formalize it on the list. And I think that would address the concern. It's a suggestion.
Yep.
Now that's exactly what would be the formally correct procedures if this was the ITF, but it isn't. Objecting to the objection, but I don't think we have much difference in practice.
Okay, let's move on. Next item on the agenda was to approve the minutes from last meeting. We'll paste them into the chat. So, does anyone object on approving those minutes? Okay, they are approved. Then we have one part on the ideal algorithm. We have two volunteers to talk about it, but Jan-Ivar was first, so maybe you could start. And I think we should spend like half an hour or 40 minutes on this topic. Just as a guideline.
Okay, I can start if that's okay. Let me paste some slides into the discussion board here, IRC. I didn't have much time to prepare anything. But pretty much it seems like we have a couple of approaches for providing a definition of ideal. And one is to say that they're merely hints to the UA. And I think we believe that there's nothing to specify in that case. On the other end would be to say this is new functionality. There's some unique behaviors, like you have non-ordered behavior that's new, and that would necessitate, we think, specifying a full algorithm, which I hope we won't do because that's a lot of work. And a third option might be just saying that this is a, that the ideal is a shortcut for a much longer series of constraint ranges in the advanced sequence. And that's, so I then ran out of time to provide slides, but the next slide, since that's something that I proposed, I want to flesh out that this number one and two don't seem that appealing, either not appealing or not allowed to talk about because if they're hints, we don't need an algorithm, we think. So for the third one, I want to clarify what we could do is perhaps provide a minimum algorithm. And by, since the shortcut pretty much equated to things we've already defined, so we could say the language here suggests if ideal is present in the constraint range, then the result must be the same as adding a series of increasingly constraining copies of that range centered around the ideal target value at the tail of the advanced array. And it could also be at the head of the advanced array then. I mean, I don't have a preference there. It just has to be defined to be something. And we could also say that it must not go beyond functionality that's already available in order to not have to, in order to have some requirement on implementation so that this is not a loophole to invent new functionality that would be non-standard. And I think, and this is sort of what I wanted to present. I'm not sure I gave enough background for everybody. But I think that in the shortcut is what I had to talk about unless there was a specific question.
So could you, this is Harald, can you just give a some more hint of what you're thinking about when you say must not provide new functionality?
Well, that was just meant as a catch-all to prevent. Maybe that's superfluous into that language, but I think Dan was concerned that this was not well-defined for testing. So the idea here that if this is just a shortcut, UAs have some flexibility here to provide, when they see this ideal keyword, to perhaps go above and beyond the most simple implementation we can think of. And this would be sort of a tethering this to make sure that it doesn't turn into more than a shortcut to what's already there as far as functionality is concerned. That was the idea there. I mean, if we're not concerned about that, we could take it out.
Okay. Let's open up the floor for comments. And I think Cullen wanted to have first comment. Or
I don't really have a comment on this. I just have as I'd asked for the agenda item to talk about a more general way of thinking about this problem. This would be one of the this would fall into one of the possible solution spaces. I was going to talk about the solution space as a whole. So I think I have more of a different topic, though I am unclear of whether that agenda item was rejected or not. I'm not sure I really care, but I don't really particularly have comments on this.
Okay, so the topic you mentioned was about ideal. So, if the topic wasn't this, when was it? What was it?
Well, I mean, I'd like to, if we're done talking about this idea and we want to sort of talk about the sort of broader ways that we could solve this problem, would like some agenda time, if possible, to talk about that. But it's not really a comment on, it's definitely about ideal, but it's not about Yanibar's proposal here. I get this proposal. It makes sense to me. I understand it. So I don't want to, if people want to discuss this, I'm happy to discuss that first. But it would be good for, I took from your comment that my agenda item was, request was rejected, and I took from Stefan's comment a second ago that I was going to talk about it after Yonevar. And I don't care, guys. I'm just confused. Tell me what you want to do.
Well, I thought I had added your item to the agenda, and we have been trying to discuss somewhat of figuring out how to make it concrete enough to make progress. But
so maybe what we should do is present my general idea here, and then we can come back to both Yonevar's proposal and mine if there's more detailed questions on it. Does that sound reasonable, people? Or if people want to talk detailed things about Yonevar's right now, let's just do that first and then move on. Either way is fine.
I'm okay to take questions after.
So let me just start with a little bit about what makes IDEAL a little bit complicated in the general sense. So first of all, I'll say on this, I think that if it does not have deterministic behavior, that it's not useful for anyone to use, and they'll go use other mechanisms. So I'm definitely, you know, my personal opinion is we definitely need deterministic behavior here, of which this algorithm 3 is definitely in that category of very deterministic behavior. So inside the deterministic behavior, let's take a case where we put the aspect ratio had to be 1:1. Okay, that's been set as a constraint. Both the min and max aspect ratio are set at 1. Just for purpose of this example, makes it easier. And the ideal width has been set to 40, and the ideal height has been set to 60, though clearly they need to be the same. And you can come up with more complex examples of this. There's many of our constraints that interact with each other, and that's why the constraint mechanism is the way it's set. Now, once we start adding this ideal thing, you're no longer really a constraint mechanism. You're into an optimization sort of question. So when we have a situation like that, we have a constraint that width and height have to effectively be equal, and we've said that the ideal value for one is 40 and the ideal value for the other is 60, we need to make a choice, first of all, in sort of looking at the solution space of, do we pick a global optimum or do we only do local greedy things? So with a global optimum, we would probably come up with the best solution to that, 40 and 60 thing was 50, right? I mean, that's the number that's sort of closest to both. And you can make arguments for slightly different numbers, but roughly speaking, a global optimum would come up with something like that. The other class of algorithms that we could use to solve this would be ones where we're more of a greedy optimization thing. So, you know, we optimize width first and we say, oh, okay, we're going with a width of 40, and we end up in that case with also a height of 40, right, just because it effectively, its ideal gets ignored because it was already pinned by the fact that we'd chosen an ideal width and we'd chosen an ideal aspect ratio. Now, with the global sort of optimization schemes, I think we know how to specify those. Those are definitely more complicated than the local greedy ones. For the use cases that I can think about, I actually sort of think that the local greedy ones would work. This algorithm 3 that Yonevar proposes in that category. But the problem with the greedy algorithms is for them to be deterministic, it needs to be very clear what the ordering of how you go through the constraints is. So my proposal probably for that would be that we did them my preferred proposal would actually be that they'd be in an array so we could have the correct ordering of them. But given that, I think that that's water under the bridge at this point. You know, one option is put them in an array so we the developer can control the order. The other option is just pick an ordering. Let's say alphabetical ordering would be the obvious ordering for them if they're in a dictionary. So that's on the greedy algorithms, we need to pick how we order. And that's a problem with this with the proposal that's there right now, is it doesn't say how they're ordered. And we need to refine that. So, and then we get down to what the actual metric is in comparing distances and trying to say if two things are close, what's better for ideal. So some things like width and height, it seems like just, Euclidean metrics, just, normal distance metrics, this, the absolute value of the two numbers makes perfect sense as the metric. Now, That said, Martin was, and that was why I was sort of like sad not to see Martin on the call. Martin had been arguing for a square, like a squared metric. So the, you know, the distance squared being the metric that we used. That certainly has some advantages, particularly in the, if we're going in the sort of global direction. So first of all, let me just pause for a second. Am I making sense? Do people sort of follow the different way I'm splitting up this space?
Yep, I think so.
Dan, it's making sense to you?
Yes. Yes, it does. When you start talking about metrics, keep in mind that we do have some sort of binary or, you know, enumerated values as well. But leaving those aside for the moment, yes, I understand.
Yeah. I think that I tend to lean towards what we do for metrics is we provide a default set of them that we expect most things would use, but we allow a constraint when it is defined if it felt it was very important for it to have a different metric to do a different one. And I'll give you an example of where this is really important. If you have some metrics that are like really almost like an inverse number of some sign, and this happens with light and some of our other things, the difference between 0.01 and 0.1 is much greater than the distance between 100 and 200 in some of these inverse metrics. So that might be the case in the future where you wanted a different metric that's specific to that constraint. I was going to bring up, you're exactly right, we have the enumerated types and the binary types. I think that the default metric for those should be, for binary types, there's really only one metric. It's one or zero. You know, it's either the same or not. There's not much else you can do. But for the enumerated types, I think that the default metric should be it's one or zero, the value is one or zero based on if the things are the same or not, okay? So that means that basically there's no real ordering to the enumerated types. Now, that said, we may get an enumerated type in the future that had a value like high, medium, low, and it might make perfect sense for that constraint to define a specific metric for it where those map to 0, 1, 2, and you used a Euclidean metric. So the difference between high and low was 2, but the difference between medium and the other two was 1, you know. So I think that we can get flexibility there without adding any complexity now. So just to sort of summarize back up to where I think this takes us is we have the decision between a global and a local space. And I think that a global or local greedy style optimization algorithm. The greedy ones are certainly easier to implement and describe than the global ones. The global ones are certainly more powerful. Whether we need that power or not is an interesting question. And given the people who wanted ideal at all, none of them are on this phone call, I feel a little hesitant to feel – I mean, I feel like this phone call is inherently biased towards let's go for the easier sort of solutions than the more powerful types of solutions because no one here cared about ideal in the first place. That's the first high-level decision. Then what we need to do inside of those decisions is decide what our metrics look like. And if we're going with the greedy algorithm, define how we order those things. So, I mean, you know, taking that back and applying that onto what Yanivar just presented as a minute ago, I would say, look, you know, what we need to do to sort of complete that out to a deterministic algorithm would be define the metrics and define the ordering of how those – I mean, when you say that the ideal things are added, you know, if you had ideal in a couple different things in the top-level stuff, how that would get it added, what order those would get added into the advanced constraints is critical, right? So, you know, that's roughly where I think about this. My tendency is to lean towards simple, well-defined metrics, define the algorithm in terms of the metrics, not define it in terms of doing something which you can't really quite do. I mean, I want to be able to do things like include, if you want to say that you want the video as large as possible, be able to do something like just put in a number like infinity And that doesn't really make an algorithm like we're currently describing this algorithm practical. So other people's thoughts on where we want to be on this global local thing as a starting point, as a high level question?
So one comment from Harald. Yeah, thank you for talking only nine minutes. The algorithm that Jan-Ivar noted, if you do first one parameter and then another parameter and then a third parameter, then it's a local algorithm. If you interleave them, it's a global algorithm. So both approaches are possible, but the text so far doesn't address whether you go one by one or interleaving.
Fair enough.
I think I prefer a global one, but only if I can figure out how to specify it in less than 100 pages.
Well, I want to confirm one thing first. This is Dan. I make sure I'm not jumping the queue here. The one thing I think I should confirm is that we, at least for the people on this call, do have agreement that, let me see, how do I want to phrase this? I'm going to come back to it. I actually need to think about the wording precisely. But it was just there's something implicit in the conversation we're having. Come back to me in a moment. Go ahead, Colin.
Colin?
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, I think that if we can be clear what we want to do here, we can define algorithms for any of these things fairly crisply in two paragraphs of text, not in 100 pages. So I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about us just getting to describe, figuring out what it is we want.
I know how to phrase it now. I just wanted to make sure that we are in agreement that we want deterministic behavior. This is something that you described, Colin, that was extremely important to you, but which the way Jan-Ivar has described his proposal, at least at the level at which he's described it so far, it is not deterministic in the same way because he hasn't said how these specific ideal values map to specific advanced values, just that they are, they start off constrained and get less constrained. And so that would be good to actually capture if there is at least agreement on this call that the behavior is deterministic, and then we can do global or local, either way.
So a question for you, Jan-Ivar. I mean, though we've sort of pointed out the algorithm as defined wasn't quite well enough defined to be deterministic, my interpretation is you meant it to be deterministic. Is that correct?
Actually, no. And to speak to that point, I assume too much about. Maybe I should have set up the expectations for why are we adding ideal. And I think it's a mistake to say that we're looking for additional functionality here, because I think that what was expressed was that certain things were too cumbersome to express with the existing advanced array, and there's also some concern with the new constraint syntax that you needed to use advanced for the very simple case of I want this range, but I also want this ideal value. So it would solve those two things. So in my view, I think people are looking for a simplification here, not additional functionality. And I don't think we need this to be more powerful. I mean, I actually don't think if we say that everything has to be deterministic, then we're saying there's no room for UA discretion at all. And I think that's a mistake. I mean, what would be fair to say is that we have to have functionality that is deterministic. But I think we're all set there. I think we have advanced, which is very powerful and very deterministic. So for users that desire determinism, I think we're all set. So I think where we're missing a bit is for people who don't have as detailed requirements, who want to say, I care a little, but here's what I care about, which is, 30% of the picture, and you, the UA, the browser, respect these few things, but I don't care how you do it. And I think that's what I think ideal is.
Make sense?
Yes. I don't see anybody else in the queue here, so I'm going to start on this. I don't know that we – I mean, I think that Justin's point was if you want to say, you know, I'd like the largest video possible, well, I mean, though in theory you can put a range of constraints in the advance, you, in practice you can't actually put enough in there to really get the biggest thing possible. And so, you know, he was saying, like, look, this is not that. But when I look at your algorithm of ranges centered on the ideal value, other than the issue of what order those things are put into the advanced things, it seems like a very deterministic algorithm. I mean, that's my idea of a deterministic algorithm. I don't think a deterministic algorithm necessarily means that all browsers need to do the same thing. I've never said that there was no room for differentiating the browsers. Just we needed to be able to understand what was going to happen and why.
Well, then maybe I'm misunderstanding, because I think in order to be deterministic, the browsers would have to work the same with me.
I think that the user of the algorithm has to be able to know what they can expect. That's what my idea of deterministic is. So
regardless of browser.
Calling the rand function and is going to generate you a random number is deterministic in my mind, even though it will return you a different number on different browsers.
But I think we're working with different definitions then.
Okay. But anyway.
Yeah, so we seem to have three classes of algorithm. It's consistent across all browsers. It's there's some direction into what it does, and it's that browsers may be different. And this, the spec doesn't say anything about this. Are those three different classes? I get the feeling
I think that's what I have heard from the conversation so far, that those are the three different candidates that I won't say have been proposed, right, the sort of candidate classes. I think that everything that people have requested can fit into one of those three categories. And just to be clear, people may hear me say it's just a hint. I actually don't care which it is, as long as it's as long as it ends up being testable. And there's a wide variety of what testable means as well. So I'm fine to let this conversation go this way, and I don't have a particular opinion for how it falls out.
It might be that we're arguing about a semantic of deterministic here that doesn't really matter. What would be more important is figure out what we think the spec should say the browser should do when it sees this ideal value, right? Or whatever. You know, it may be that, like, if we can be concrete about what we want the spec to say, that we'll all notice that we don't care about this topic of which of those three categories it falls in. I mean, I'm pretty sure when we take this back to the people who asked for ideal, that if you put in an ideal width of 50 and height of 50 and no other constraints, and the browser is perfectly capable of producing 50 by 50, that they would view the text said anything can happen as not really quite meeting their needs.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I agree as well. I think maybe I misunderstood Colin when he said deterministic. I'm worried that would limit UAs from trying to make better algorithms that, like the one that Mark proposed, that could do the lowest of squares. And I guess what I wanted to propose as a minimum algorithm was to imply that UAs could go, would not need to be limited by the one that we specified, provided it was limited by the advanced array. And I should also say that since I got my, I'm assuming we still have the constraint-supported function to deal with the web IDL problem, so I'm pretty happy with that. So I'm not necessarily married to ideal here. But I also prefer, as an implementer, that it be as little work as possible. So I would love to see it implementable using the existing algorithm.
But it seems to me that we're more or less saying that everyone could be happy with something that is on the lines of what Yaniva proposed, but we have to say something about. But it would be better if we could set expectations for the global versus local optimization trade-off.
Yeah, and we also had a question about metrics if we go the global optimization.
But yeah. I mean, we have the same thing. I mean, Yanivars doesn't say what happens with, he uses the word centered, which inherently means a linear metric for integers and is undefined for enums or whatever, right? So it's just underspecified for that. But obviously we could fix, I get what he's getting at here. We can extend this algorithm up to cover those cases trivially. That's not a big deal.
Okay, I think there's only one way we're going to reach a solution on this. And as someone who has no interest in IDEAL, I'm probably not the best one to provide this. So I'm proposing work for some other unspecified individual here. But that other work really should be to just provide a long list of IDEAL values, long list of examples, right? You say, IDEAL width of this, IDEAL height of this, like you did, Cullen. But then actually also as part of the example, you have to say, and the browser is capable of doing this, this, and this, right? So that you actually have the specific scenario. So the browser is able to do this. This is what's specified. These outcomes would be reasonable. These outcomes would not be reasonable. And I think it's only by actually looking at those examples that we're going to reach an agreement on this.
Well, let's go back to my very simple example from the very beginning, which is the aspect ratio has been set to 50, or to 1:1, and the width is 40 and the height 60. And let's say we're going
I just note that this example is a user who can't make up his mind, right?
Well, no. This example could happen by the user receiving the video has stretched the size of the window for the incoming video that they're going to display on to 40 by 60 because they just resized their window like that. And the camera producing the video has a 1:1 aspect ratio. Now, obviously that's a lame aspect ratio, but it just makes it easier. I mean, obviously it would be more likely to be 4:3, right? But I mean, that just makes the numbers harder, but you know what I mean? So I don't think this is a particularly contrived example. I think this is a very realistic example that I think it's one of the things the browser is going to get all the time. And the reason is it's not one user, it's two users. One user has a camera that has certain limits, and the other user has resized their window to a certain size. So it's not just like a buggy application. In this example, if we took the basic algorithm that the Anavar proposed here, but we try and add the question of how we order things, okay? As Harold pointed out, if we interleaved these range and width things being added, this algorithm would actually produce values of 50 for both of them. That's the first time we'd hit things being constrained, and we'd have the global optimal. But we'd need to say that how you construct these ideals is you put in the advanced constraints, all the ideals that are one away, then all the ideals that are two away, then all the ideals that are three away, in order going up. And 50 would be where we've got the first intersection. The other way that we could interleave those constraints is we say we would need to decide a sort order. I proposed alphabetical. So you'd put, all the heights first, and then all the widths second, and in that case, the answer we would get is both the width and height would be 60. Right?
But why does it have to be deterministic in that sense when you can already use the advance the right to do this? I mean,
if you actually stuff in exactly this into the advanced array as the proposed that you do, you'd find that the algorithm did not really actually run in a very reasonable time. I mean, if I'm supporting, you know, up to 4K by 4K video and I put 4,000 entries into this thing for both the width and height, I haven't tried it. I don't know. You've implemented this. Would it work fine?
But I mean, if we want people to optimize and do things better, it seems better to me to let browsers fight it out here and do what they do best and compete about, use the ideal to compete about which web browser does it the best. Because when the web developer says ideal, it's kind of saying to the browser, here, this would be ideal for me. You try to reach that. It doesn't mean I have to have the ideal. So one way I think would be to specify, maybe I underspecified, we could say explicitly that if multiple ranges use ideal, let the browser order them any way it wants. And if ranges are large or unconstrained or using double as a type, let the UA use any stepping increment that it wants. That way, browsers have a space to excel in and solve this and make it fast.
I'm pretty sure I'll object to that one. I suspect Justin is. But, I mean, that's certainly one design point, no question about it.
I just don't think that's very sad. API should have deterministic outcomes. And, that makes me very sad. And I'm sad Justin's not here, too, because I've heard Justin say the same thing a number of times. Now, maybe he doesn't believe it in this particular case, but is it now time for me to be Comment 22 guy and say that if this is where we've gotten by trying to avoid the fingerprinting surface, that, like, we should reboot it?
Well, I think,
Janivar, do you see any real advantage to having that be that undefined? I mean, like, you know, would you have a problem with just specifying whatever it is you guys plan to implement?
Well, I guess I want to avoid work at this point. So it sounds like if we're required to specify this further, that's more work. And it seems like a false choice, given that one is saying it's a hint that's not specified or deterministic. And then we're saying, saying the other extreme is to provide a full algorithm, so it's fully deterministic. It seems odd that there's no room in the middle. And I'm not opposed to taking the time to overly specify this. I guess I'm not that married to this ideal concept. But if others are, I just want to be done here. But if others feel differently, that's fine too.
Harold, you said you had a preference for the global. So in this example of like 40 and 60 width and height, you know, you'd prefer that the answer came back 50, not 60 or 40, is that?
My reason for saying that is that I kind of feel that if you do something very, very far away from ideal in one aspect and just to satisfy another one, you're likely to surprise the user, and I don't like surprising the user.
Yeah.
My headache is that I don't see how this can be specified in a way that allows reasonable, interoperable, and testable implementations in a reasonable amount of text without saying something like, okay, for this specific example, it comes out that way. And for the rest, you just do what makes sense to you.
Well, you proposed earlier a fairly simple specification of that was a minor modification to Yanivar's, which seemed to me to be would have resulted in the answer of 50 and was fairly clear how to specify.
Yep. If you make reasonable assumptions about things like the relative step size of the two, of the scopes in the two directions and which sort order you use and so on. It's a number of things that have to be specified in order to make testable results for it that worries me.
So just to find a way out here, so if we did specify that it had to be in alphabetical order and some kind of stepping increment, then that would solve this?
I think so. And look, we'd also want to add to the end of the algorithm, too, or the end of the text, like, you know, a note that was like, obviously browsers don't have to actually implement it like this. They just have to implement an algorithm that comes out with the same answer that this algorithm would have come out with had it been run.
Yeah, that would work for me.
So I think this will work as long as it does properly handle the case of I request a width of 50, a height of 80, you know, ideal for both, right? And if the browser can do it and there are no other constraints, it just gives me a 50 by 80, right? Because I think Yanivar is right in the sense that ideal is being put in here for the simple cases and sort of the it's two things. I guess it's simple and it is gravity also. But I think users would be really surprised if they knew that the browser, the camera, could do what they're asking for, and they didn't get it. Now, if they give conflicting stuff, then I'm not sure that there is any algorithm that we're all going to agree on because we all have different use cases. So the algorithm that you suggested, Cullen, is fine as a compromise algorithm. Because in those in-between cases where reasonable human beings can disagree on what reasonable behavior would be, all we need is an answer.
Right. As long as we know what the answer is, the developers will reconstruct their constraints to get the answer they want in the situation they're in, right?
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Right. If it doesn't work the way they want, right, they will adjust the constraints accordingly to make it do what they want.
Look,
yes.
This is Edgar. This is insane. Like, we're discussing, like, specifying some incredibly overcomplicated algorithm for having people gesture at the browser to get them to do what they want. Merely because we don't want to backwalk on this decision not to let people look at what the devices are. So, Harald, what would be required to formally reconsider the question of whether of simply enumerating the devices and their properties and then selecting them? So I think that I think that people did not understand what they were doing when they made that decision. And
actually, it's not that simple. It's not that simple, Edgar.
Why?
Right. It's not that simple because there are multiple tabs, multiple applications, et cetera, using the same devices. We've talked about this before, right? And as a result, the moment you start actually doing specific selection, whatever, then you start blocking out opportunities for multiple applications, tabs, et cetera, to use the same device at the same time, where you just let the user agent find something that fits within your constraints. And then there are also
maybe issues
where –
JavaScript is a single-threaded operation.
Let me just finish. And then the other thing is that, again, over peer connections, there may be cases where there may be some sort of back optimizations that can occur because of just knowing in general what the end, you know, one end or the other is willing to live with. Okay, now, what was your comment?
I don't understand your argument about I'm not saying – so first of all, I'm not saying that it is utterly dominant to do that. I'm saying it because people much more of what they want without creating this whole complicated nightmare we just put ourselves into. We've been arguing about for the past year. And so the mere fact that there might be some possible disadvantage to having direct control is not itself an argument. And second, like – the practical matter that people are going to ask these devices one or two at a time, and JavaScript is not a multi-threaded system, so you're simply going to get what you get, and the next guy who asks will get what is left, which is what's going to happen with constraints as well.
That's not true with constraints, because actually with constraints, the user agent can adjust as the next guy comes along to ask for something. It may adjust what you are getting because you've told it that you're fine with this range.
I would be
right.
I completely oppose that being the case. And if that's the case, that's better not say that.
It actually has said that for more than a year.
Well, then I will have an objection to that, and I'll file a bug against it. That's insane.
I mean, Edgar, I will back down. I'm not saying whether it's insane or not, but I will. That is definitely what it currently says.
Okay, I'm prepared to believe that. I never noticed it.
And it has meant that since day one, actually.
It's dumb on day one. It's dumb now. I'm sorry, but like I don't want my application getting weird behavior because someone else asked for the camera.
But you
Why
can't
would,
control
it's not
that.
Weird behavior. Oh my gosh. Okay, so I think we're dealing with people having really short memories here is what's going on. But let me just say that instead of like unwinding everything, we could also ask, apparently we're missing some people who have opinions on IDEAL and how it should work. And that's what got us to this point, right? We're now talking about IDEAL, which is intended to do two things. One, give you a very simple means of specifying, give me this thing if it's available, and also simultaneously specifying, if that's not available, give me something close to this, and we're discussing what close means, okay? And that's what's new. That's what's being proposed to be added through IDEAL. This is one of the major arguments I've had against IDEAL, actually, is that we're going to go down a big rat hole of specifying what close means. Now, if we can come to an agreement on what close means or how precise we have to be in the definition of close, then fine. I think if we can do that, great, then we're done. If not, then we have all of the mechanisms to provide all the control that application developers need without IDEAL. But again, the people who've most argued for it are not here on this particular conversation. I'm not sure why, but they're not.
I mean, IO Justin's at IO. But this is just the fifth epicycle in this whole never-ending thing of like, how do I like give the browser some idea of what my preferences are?
Well, let me propose another thing then. Like, so what if we removed IDEAL? So let me paste the URL in here to IRC. If we removed IDEAL, then we don't have the exact IDEAL pair to deal with what happens at the top level of constraints. So they would all be required again. We could put that back under
mandatory
label. You need to
open up that document.
Sorry?
You need to open up access to the document.
Sorry. One second, public. Okay, done. Can you see it now?
Just a moment.
Sorry, my bad.
Yes.
Okay, so if we don't have IDEAL and we don't have exact, everything at the top level we discussed would have to be required. We could shove that under a mandatory header again, and we would have a very familiar syntax. As long as we still have the get supported constraints function that solves the IDEAL problem, I'd be happy with that.
But just a clarifying question here. What does having the mandatory dictionary that there? Why? Oh, I see. That just needed to separate it from the optional versus just having those objects floating directly in the video level dictionary. That's
right.
Like I was wondering why we needed the mandatory in there, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Because at the interim, I think there was objection to making everything in the top level mandatory or required without some people thought that was too strict. I think Dom and others. And we're very close to the syntax that most people have been familiar with over the last year and a half. So, either way, you could have all the top-level keys be required by default without a mandatory label. That works too. And also, advances the rename back to optional here. It was just sort of to provoke your reaction that this isn't that far from where we were a half year ago.
Yeah. All right. understand.
Jan Ivar, I mean, the problem is that the people who argued mostly for ideal are not on this call, so it's it's a bit difficult. But I see someone on the queue, Microsoft.
Yes, this is Shijin. Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. So I just wanted to comment. We like the ideal definition and as a hint and nothing really specific. Because, you know, the system might have different devices. Capture devices might have different capability, different settings. And also based on the scenarios. For some, you know, capture-only scenario, the behavior is more deterministic. And for RTC scenario, based on the bandwidth, actually, you know, the user agent can change the setting internally based on the range, minimum and maximum range, based on the bandwidth, based on encoding power, everything in the system. So having this ideal, in a way, to define the what the browser want to get as close as possible, that's good to me. And it's difficult to define, you know, the close, you know, how close that should be, given the dependency on the device, dependency on the scenarios.
I think Carden spoke to the last point earlier when he talked about metrics and how to define them.
And for any application wanted to have, you know, exact predictable behavior, you can use exact. I think that's the purpose, you know, and when we talk about this during the interim meeting in May, there's a balance between ideal and exact. And it gives the application enough control and also gives the enough flexibility to the user agent implementations.
Well, I mean, none of these algorithms that are being proposed in any way stop the user agent from changing resolution due to bandwidth issues or all those things. I mean, I get the points you're making, but all of these are well within allowing that to do and just trying to provide some guidance for the application to understand what happens when there are no other overriding constraints on what can happen, right? Like, you know.
Yeah. So having only minimal and the maximum range is not really quite enough. Having ideal precision is really helpful. And also, you know, in case people really want to enforce something, having that exact parameter will be, you know, useful as well.
Yep.
Based on scenario, for capture-only scenario, you know, people might want to do that. Anyway, that's my comment.
Anyone else in the queue?
Here. Okay, so, I think
I was just going to make one comment towards Acker's comment, which was, you know, this ideal does move us into this being an optimization problem. I don't think it's a hard one. I mean, I can see how we can specify it, but that was actually one of the things that we agreed long ago that we were not going into, and I agree with the speaker that just said Microsoft, and the gentleman from Microsoft just said it, that it is useful to have ideal. And that's been Justin's point as well. But you know, we you know, at what point did you know, at what point do we actually say we don't like this design and reconsider it? It's a good question.
Yeah.
And in what forum? I think we have a conclusion more or less at this point, which is that we have, how would we say, promising discussion, but we don't have a consensus, and we're severely hampered by the fact that the people who argued most for a deal have not shown up today. So I think we'll have to defer this to the lists.
I mean, it sounded to me like Carlin and Dan and Jan Ivar had some agreement around the proposal.
So to be clear, what I want to say is I see a range of proposals. I think I know how to write up any of them, including Jan Ivar's here, in ways that Jan Ivar can easily implement them. But I could care less whether it's global or greedy I mean, we need some. There are some requirement level issues that we need to deal with here, and once those are dealt with, I think we can write up an algorithm that, I think I know how to write up an algorithm that meets those needs. Maybe not. And then people can decide how they're complicated or not. I'm not really arguing for anything one way or the other. I'm saying that we won't solve this without answering those questions.
You're arguing for that we should resolve it. It's a local or global optimization, or and what the metrics are and so on first.
Sure. So one, I think it should be deterministic, but that's the one part that I do care about. But, I mean, on global or local, I heard Harold argue slightly for global, which makes sense to me. I suspect Justin would say the same thing if he was here. I suspect Martin would say the same thing if he was here. I don't know. I've heard then inside of there we need to define what the metrics are, particularly for enums, and we need to talk about the ordering of things even in the global. Well, if we're going with the global solution, the ordering no longer matters. So. And once we have that, it's pretty easy to figure out how to write up an algorithm. And then I've heard from Ecker that, maybe we should get rid of this whole thing and just go, this was driven by a fingerprinting issue, and maybe we should just move away from the whole algorithm, right? And I'm not arguing for anything myself. I don't want to come across that way. I'm happy to help people just write up whatever it is they think that they're trying to argue for, but, I do want it done. And therefore, I'm willing to help people write up the thing and understand the space so that they can write up complete algorithms.
But Carlin, you indicated what you thought most people figure it should be on global versus local and so on. Would you take on an action point to write up a proposal with assuming global, for example, and so on?
Yanavar, are you willing to work with me on adapting your proposal to be a global proposal, but keeping more or less the same form, staying with roughly the same form you currently have?
I mean, sure. I mean, whatever I can do to help. I mean, I don't feel like I have a strong stake in this either, so sure.
So why don't the two of us take that on as an action to write up? I'm on vacation next week, so it needs to be the week after that.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so you have an action item on Karim and Yaniva to work further on the proposal. And then that consumed the first 1 hour and 5 minutes. Good. I think we got somewhere.
Yeah, so we better get on. And the next item is your, I think, Harald. Consensus on how long permissions last.
Yes. So that was part of my slides for the bug walkthrough, I think. So I have Let me see. Could someone dig up the link to the PDF I sent in the archive? So I think we have a clear picture of what people want now. And I think stored permissions last until they're revoked. They include the permission to view labels. And if you have single-use permissions, that is not stored permissions, they last until the device closes. And the device closes when all tracks that are sourced from it have stopped. And the permission to view labels lasts until all devices are closed.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't see. Oh, there it is. Thank you.
Sorry about that. It's on slide 5.
By view labels, let me just make sure I understand, Harold. Are you talking about essentially viewing, we don't call it capabilities, but it's the list of available devices, or do you mean something else?
The names for available devices, the human readable text labels.
Right, the media source infos or whatever the name is now. Yeah, that one.
Yep.
Right.
So we already agreed that it's okay for anyone to view the number of devices and the type of devices, that is audio or video, and without any permissions. But we have said that the label can only be viewed by stuff that has some permission. And we already rejected the idea of having a separate API for manipulating, for asking for permission to view those labels. So this is the simplest thing. This seems to be where we are based on previous decisions.
Well, Harold, this is just a question of understanding this here. So I don't understand. I wasn't involved enough with the sidebar discussion at the last meeting about where you came up with the two different indications that are going to be displayed to people. But I think permissions need to be tied not to some event like close. That has no meaning to me. They need to be tied to something that's visible to the user, like the permissions. So I'm not quite understanding how close ties to those or whatever. I'm just physical and saying is this definition doesn't – I don't understand it well enough to be able to have an opinion on it. I think it needs to be tied to something concrete.
So the device close – I mean, the you have the proposed text in the full. So, and the discussion actually happened on stage. So you were sitting there. The thing is, it's mostly based on input from Ecker, actually. That says, okay, as long as you have a device open, obviously you have access to the device. If you close the media stream that sourced from that device, then if JavaScript closes the stream that has access to the device, or if the user revokes permission naturally, then permission goes away.
Colin, I think I was probably the person who was pushing on this the hardest. My concern was that the default behavior for single-use permissions be that you don't end up having something you're holding on to by accident for like some enormously long period of time, right?
Right.
I think that my understanding is the point of the indicators, right, is there's one indicator that says I in principle could be listening to your media if I wish to be, and another indicator that says I actually am listening to your media, right? Although that really only applies to the camera, because the microphone, as you know, the indicators are terrible, right? You only get one indicator, which is I'm listening, right? As a practical matter, right? So the indicator light, which is let's just have the green light. We'll have the camera. The green light is on if I'm actually capturing media, but if I mute the media, the green light goes off. But the indicator that says I could be looking at your camera stays on as long as I could be looking at your camera at all, even if I've currently muted the media. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, obviously, that's why I found this weird tied to close. It would have made more sense to me if it said the permission lasts as long as the indicator's on, but it just all seemed very recursive to me, like the indicator's on as long as the permission lasts, or what? I don't understand.
as a single-use application, I mean, we have to write down somehow what causes you to lose the ability to So again, like I'm on a call and I've got your camera and I'm like transmitting your camera to the other side and I want to video mute temporarily, but I have the ability to get the camera back without prompting you. So, what is the gesture I do to lose that ability? And so my claim is the gesture you do to temporarily stop acquiring but retain the ability is you mute, and the gesture you do to lose the ability is you close all the streams.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that
makes sense. I didn't get that from this slider discussion, but that makes sense.
I'm not saying this text is correct, but if we agree on that, I think I've got to go over it more carefully. But if we agree on the principle, then presumably we can make the text match it.
Yep. Sure.
Yep.
But I agree on the principle.
And as far as as far as the definitions being recursive, the cause of the indicators is acting by JavaScript. The effect of the indicator is that the indicator goes on and off. And so that is the sequence in which it has to be specified too.
Okay.
Hold on.
I think it's a little bit better described in the pull request that's currently on your in the GitHub.
Can I have some input there for the actual thing we were discussing? I think this is about the lights. It was we kind of drifted away. Regarding access to the labels, I have a comment about that.
Yes.
Should we take
Go ahead.
That now? Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is, I sent a mail to that discussion regarding if the label, I mean, how long you have access to the labels. I don't know. No one replied to it. But the thing is, it's no real use taking away something that has been given to JavaScript, because someone can actually take all the labels, save them in a separate structure, and even though all the device permissions are revoked, you still have all these the information you once had. So I don't think there's any use really in taking away the labels from devices that have the script had access to once during the session. So in the proposal I sent was that you shouldn't take anything away, because that makes it strange for scripts when there was a string there and suddenly there's not a string there, but hide information, hide new information instead until you have access once again. I don't remember exactly how I wrote it, but it's somewhere in the mail archive. So.
Yeah,
but taking away stuff is kind of strange.
Yeah, the case where it matters is actually access to new devices that are plugged in. And it made my head hurt to think about the situation where you have, you see, seven devices with names and one device without a name.
Yeah, but I don't. Why is that? Because you don't have access to that device. I don't know. Do you have all or nothing? If you, isn't it strange if suddenly three devices you had the label of, suddenly they disappear? But you could store them somewhere else, I mean.
I certainly agree that labels aren't like access to the camera microphone. That is to say that if you once you have them, you can stuff them somewhere. You know, it is true that I suppose if the labels change, then you wouldn't have access to that. But that doesn't seem like a relatively modest kind of security enhancement.
So I'm going to point out, there is a queue. I'm on the queue, but I'm actually going to ask a different question, not about labels. So I'm willing to wait on the queue until we're done with the label discussion.
Any more comments on labels?
This is Shi Jun. I'd like to comment on the anything from a security privacy perspective. Anything permission can be stored will be a risk, because the page is dynamic. All the web content is not really trustable from security perspective. And even the main page is okay, but that could be iframes, could be other things being loaded in the page. And then that will come from different origin, but still can form the attack vector. And that's a typical case for people formed attack. So really, by looking at the spec and you know, similar to the single use permission, actually, if you translate that to just application calling the get user media, every time application calls get user media, that should be assigned to, from a security perspective, to pop up the permission UI. But that can come from anywhere on the page. Even the main page is a trusted domain, but there could be other things sideloaded. That's a comment.
Okay, Dan,
I'm not sure
you're next.
Got that.
Yes, at the risk of, you know, opening a sore subject, just before this, the call, I went and reviewed every email on the list that had to do with permission, you know, in the last month or so, just to make sure I caught everything. And one of the topics that didn't look like it, the way things ended is the way that I agree with, but I'm not sure everybody would agree with that. And so I just want to ask about it, and it's the reload issue, right? Harold, are you making any statement about that yet, or is that something you would like to discuss separately and later?
My thought was that since we're tying the permission to the survival of JavaScript objects, we've implicitly said that no, we don't survive reload.
Okay, which matches what I personally would like. So I'm happy with that, but I'm just bringing it up to make sure that either you were planning on us deciding on that and making a statement about it, or you were not planning on that.
No, I thought
it's resolved.
Make my assumption explicit. So,
okay, yeah, thank
you for making that explicit. No, reload. Permission to survive reload.
Again, comment on the reload. I wanted to clarify, reload is different from let's say the browser suspension, and then coming back, you know, from a background to foreground. Because that's really still the same side. The page is not being reloaded. I just wanted to clarify. Because on mobile devices, I think on phone, you know, Android, whatever, browser can be suspended, and then coming back from background, become active again, and then the page should be alive. And the user agent should try the best to keep that going.
Yes, in that case, also the JavaScript object survives.
Yes,
right. As a user, I would largely expect that too. As opposed to, I hit the reload button, and why isn't it, you know, why isn't it starting again?
So if you're reloading from the server, the page can change already.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Whether it's cached or not, you are requesting a reload from the server. Yes, right.
Yeah, that's a new page.
Reinitialization of the page and all of that. Yep.
Yep.
Okay. We're done with that one.
Sorry, could you just conclude what for the minutes that we have an accurate summary of where we are on this one?
So my conclusion for the minute is that it seems that the proposal has no strong objections, and that we have to make sure that the text is actually clear about what it says.
Yeah, okay, sounds good.
Yep. Okay, Harold, I guess you'll just move on in your slides here for some time.
Yep. Okay, so if we go back to the beginning of the slide deck, I just wanted to, so now we're on the agenda point on bug bashing, and we've got 10 minutes left, oops. So there are a couple of slides of intro, including a slide listing all the bugs that I don't talk about elsewhere. The font is more or less a joke. The link is not. So we cover the permissions. Another bug that I'm not sure what we should do with is the stop function and the ended event, 25248, which is we have some APIs that do what we currently specify, saying that if you cause the stop yourself, then you don't need a signal back. You already know, so we don't make a signal. But it seems like I kind of like the argument that that if you say that the stop handler is called no matter why the thing stops, that's more consistent behavior. So I'd like to seek opinion on that one.
Yeah, this is Adam. I think I'm one of the few that thinks we should keep it the way it is, because I think that's more consistent with how other APIs work in the web platform. And for stop, it's not a big deal, but for stuff like add and remove stream, I know that people want to fire events in those cases as well. But in that case, it gets a bit tricky, because when it's different when the user adds something to with add stream and with add track, and when the user agent does that, because it's really about what's on the next line of code, if there is a synchronous operation or if it's a synchronous one. So I think we should keep it the way it is.
Yeah, fighting with event is always asynchronous, so it's so what's on the next line of code is obvious, but not what's on the next, what will happen, I mean, after you return.
I was a bit unclear. I mean, what I was trying to say was that if you do something, is that a request for do the work in the upcoming event dispatch process or do the work right now? Because if the user agent is doing something, that it wants to modify something in JavaScript, the user agent posts a task on the event queue, and when the event gets picked up or the task gets picked up, stuff happens. But when the user does something, normally you can do stuff synchronously on the event loop, and it happens right away. So the kind of the way the work is performed is different if the UA does it or if the user does it. When I say user, I mean the script.
What other comments?
This is Shijun. To me, it's very helpful to have other events here as much as possible. Imagine if you're writing a kind of a JavaScript library. One is a kind of a lower layer library driving the capture and or the WebRTC scenario. The other library is a UI library, which is more replaceable by different, you know, organizations. For the UI library to work properly, usually you need to have all these events. So, the application, the developers don't have to introduce all the other kind of their own private interface between the two libraries. Just a comment on that.
Okay, we have one of each opinion. Do we have a third one?
Right, so the question, I know you said the question is to fire or not to fire, and you're describing consistency with other APIs, but to make sure, you know, I understand this one, I'm going to phrase it a different way, which is that I think what you're asking is the ended event, whether it fires only when a stream stops outside of script control versus whether it fires under all cases of a track stopping, even including the script having done that by calling stop.
Yeah, that's correct. That's the question.
Right. So then it has to do, again, yeah, it is about what code goes in that handler, right, for the ended event. Is the mental expectation for the programmer that code is only to handle something that they didn't cause, or is it to handle all cases of stopping? I think it's more general to have it handle all cases of stopping, because you can always check and see whether your script called it, right? That's all. I mean, whether your script caused it by calling stop. However, Adam's analogy I didn't like as much, because again, like the, you know, add stream, remove stream. You know, my mental model is that I only get an on-add stream if the remote side has added a stream, not if I've added a stream, right? So those to me are very different. Those are events about, you know, something happening caused by the remote side only.
Yeah, yeah, I was talking about add track. I think I said add stream at some point, but I was talking about adding track to a media stream. Not adding streams to a peer connection.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it's all local, essentially. Yeah, and you know, I could live with either one. I think I would tend to argue for fire in both cases, but that's just a personal preference on my part.
Tom, thank you.
So to add more different voices, I would side with doing what other APIs do. I think it's easy enough to complement in the local code with firing every time if that's what you prefer. But more importantly, I think it's a pretty minor decision, so we shouldn't stop on it, basically. So, I mean, I guess I'm suggesting doing it the way the others do seems the best consistency path, because it's always easy to replicate it in your user code if needed, and that if we discover that this is entirely broken, we can fix it later in any case.
And I'm fine with that, too. I didn't mean to express too strong a preference here.
Yeah, for close, it's not a big deal. But if you do, the example I've written in some mail is actually with add track. If you do add track and remove track, you will actually, when you get to stable state, you will actually get an event. Let's say it's an event caused by this direct script operation. You will actually get an event with saying that there's a track added to this stream, but that track could actually have been removed by synchronous code already. So I don't think the event is very useful in those local cases when you do direct modifications. But that's simply my point of view. That the upcoming event could not be telling the truth.
That's an argument for not firing.
In the closed case, it doesn't even matter.
It seems to me that we have more people arguing in favor of not firing than firing, but we don't have any very strong arguments. But I think since it's in the spec already, I suggest I'll be suggesting that we call this no change needed, and say keep it the way it is.
It seems okay to me. We can, as I said, you know, comment it. We can fix it in the future if needed.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. Okay. Next one on my list. Oops. Yes.
I think we're out of time.
Yep. So we'll take the. So we got the two bugs settled, I think, and we'll take the rest of the list. So I have a slide here on how you can help and make sure it's clear. Make sure your bugs are clear. And if you really want specific text in the document, make a pull request. Pull requests are really easy to manage as long as they're simple and obvious and fresh. And then the editors and the JS can do the job of saying, yes, this looks right.
And by the way, as editors, I mean, we really do realize that we can break the freshness, and that happens sometimes, and we're sorry.
Yeah, apologies. But also, if it's controversial, please, it's just so much easier to have it discussed on the list in email versus that people read versus discussed halfway in bug trackers, halfway in pull requests, whatever. Make sure there's a fair amount of agreement on what change would be needed. Now, some changes are very obvious and you don't need any agreement. Everyone's going to agree, right? Like, you know, this is wrong. This is a typo. This is an old name.
Yep.
Good point.
Okay. Are we done? Are we not done? But are we
closing
okay, something now?
We're closing, and we'll have one action and two bugs sorted.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Let's hope we can go forward.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks, buddy.